You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator and your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked-about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host. And my guest today is Nicholas Nick Tedesco, who is the President and Chief Executive Officer of the National Center for Family Philanthropy. NCFP serves as a hub of learning, connection, and collaboration designed to resource and activate a community of families to be intentional philanthropic stewards. Nick is a passionate advocate for philanthropy and brings over a decade of experience partnering with donors and their families to establish and meet their giving goals. Before Nick joined NCFP, he was a senior advisor at the J.P. Morgan Philanthropy Center, where he provided clients with insights and services to help them meet their philanthropic objectives. And he also served as a relationship manager at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, where he was one of the people who helped to launch the Giving Pledge, which was an effort led by Bill and Melinda Gates at the time, also Warren Buffett, to encourage the world's wealthiest individuals and families to commit the majority of their wealth to philanthropy before they passed away. Nick, welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast.
Thank you so much, Art. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Nick, I thought we would get started by diving into your background, which is really fascinating. I noticed in reading that you've spent time in the corporate sector, working in the philanthropic space at J.P. Morgan. You've also worked on the Giving Pledge at the Gates Foundation. And now, in your current role, you're working with families to help them manage their philanthropic activities. How did you come to this work? What was it that sort of led you in this direction?
Absolutely, Art. I'm more than happy to share a little bit about my background. So I've been in the social sector for about 2 decades. I started my career at a nonprofit focused on children and families, was working to provide programs that would help to empower individuals and families and communities throughout the United States. And it was during my time at that organization that I had an early introduction to philanthropy and really fell in love with the opportunities that are available when philanthropy is done well. With that opportunity, I was invited to join the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to help build and launch the Giving Pledge in 2010. And it was during my time at the Pledge that I really was reflecting on the conversations that were happening amongst the members themselves. And there seemed to be a central theme that was carried throughout each of the conversations, which was this noticeable gap between intent and action. We hosted a number of small dinners, meetings, and events that really held space for donors to share their stories, their inspirations, and their struggles. And truly, one of the most significant things that I heard is the universal challenge to deploy capital, particularly at scale. I heard time and time again that individuals and families, those who had signed the pledge, were and are eager to translate their intent to action, but they're limited in their time and their resources and their expertise and their confidence. And I also was noticing that the sector that's been built to support them is fragmented, it's opaque, and it's difficult to navigate. And so I started to ask the question of why. And so I stepped out of the Gates Foundation and joined J.P. Morgan's private bank in their philanthropy center to serve as a senior advisor to work with individuals and families across the wealth spectrum to really test this hypothesis that there is, in fact, a gap between intent and action. And it was, in fact, validated. Almost everyone that I talked to throughout my time at JP Morgan as an advisor was asking how they can do more, how they can do it better, who they can turn to learn from and learn alongside with, what tools and solutions they can adopt and embrace, what networks they can join. And so again, I started asking myself the question of how a sector that has been built to ultimately support philanthropists in their decisions was so difficult to navigate. And so I started to explore what I might do to help contribute to a solution. And at that time was approached about the opportunity to succeed Ginny Esposito, the founder of the National Center for Family Philanthropy, and leapt at the opportunity, realizing that it's a brilliant network and a moment in time for the network to be able to reimagine an organization that can be a partner, be a shepherd to philanthropic families who are such critical levers for change.
Wow. So many questions come up from what you've given us just now. And first, let me just acknowledge Ginny Esposito, who's been a 20-plus year friend, did remarkable work building the National Center and making it, I think, the go-to sort of organization for families that are looking for information on how to be more effective in their giving. Ginny, by the way, was also one of the founding board members of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance, the organization I head, and she was also on the board at the time when I was hired. So I can say nothing but tremendously good things about Ginny and how fortuitous for you it is to follow her and come into an organization that she's laid such a great foundation for and now take it to another level.
It's big shoes to fill, Art. She is a legend, and I am grateful to have her partnership in the leading of this organization.
Well, you know, you mentioned the giving pledge, and I can't but take this opportunity to ask you about how billionaires sort of think about their giving, since most of our listeners will never have access to those individuals and have the opportunity to ask questions. But, you know, I guess the first question on someone's mind might be, wait a minute, what's so hard about giving money away? You know, what is it that they struggle with, you know, in just finding people to give money to? There's so many needs and so many causes out there. What's the big challenge? Putting yourself in their shoes, if you could, how might they answer that question?
Yeah, it's a great question to reflect on. In many ways, it's a crisis of opportunity, right? There are so many good causes, issues, communities to support, so many opportunities to pursue, that more often than not, when individuals and families are looking to put capital to work, particularly at scale, they feel a bit overwhelmed, rightfully so. And so the question comes back to, how do you work through those feelings of being overwhelmed? And how do you weigh your individual interests, the collective interests of a family, and the opportunities at hand? And for many individuals and families, particularly at the billionaire subset, you're often running businesses at the same time. You're running families at the same time. So philanthropy is more often than not going to be your primary focus. And so historically, there hasn't been an urgency to put that capital to work beyond the distribution requirements that are part of our tax code. And so there has been this stuttering effect. This effect of waiting for perfection, and ultimately perfection then becomes the enemy of the good. And so my mission truly professionally is to help individuals and families get going with this work and recognize that you learn by doing and that there is no such thing as perfect, particularly in philanthropy, and that the world needs your capital, your time, your resources, your partnership, and your awareness now. And so, you know, I think there's a couple of added layers of complexity with billionaires. One is reputation, right? I think there is a lot of fear around making a move that might reputationally put you in the spotlight. And so I think that adds to a bit of the paralysis that billionaires feel around making the decisions to put their capital to work. I also think that there's an emotional attachment to wealth that is very hard to quantify. Many individuals and families, most if not all, have spent their lives investing in their professional pursuits that have yielded this capital. And, you know, to then turn around and give it away again often creates an artificial bar, a bar that is very hard to leap over, right? It's the, you know, this was my sweat equity. And to put this to work, I want to ensure that the outcomes are going to be significant and it's going to be a success. And the question is, what is success? We have to reframe that question. We have to think about that differently. And we have to acknowledge again that just doing this work is contributing to success because we all are learning together and that this is a collective effort. But I do think at the end of the day, there's a few things that ultimately play a role in the challenge here. It is a crisis of opportunity. It's a crisis of time, right? Because again, they're focusing on their businesses, their families. And I do think in many ways, it's a crisis of the unknown, right? And so when you look at all of those together, I think again, it creates a bit of a hesitation that hopefully we can start to help individuals and families overcome.
Would you agree then that maybe Mackenzie Scott is kind of tossing this concern that many in that class have sort of on its ear? I mean, she seems to be just giving money away in a more bold and unrestrained fashion. What's your thoughts about how she's going about it at this point?
Absolutely. She is upending the system in the most positive ways. She is showing that you can put capital to work. You can do it with a very lean infrastructure. You can do it in very significant and meaningful ways that will change outcomes for organizations and ultimately for communities. And she is showing that you can do this in the near term because there is an awareness that Mackenzie has around the need for her capital now. And so I think it's an extraordinary testament to what's possible with philanthropy. I also think that the approach that Mackenzie has taken, this approach of go broad and really empower organizations to live into a fuller version of themselves and accomplish their missions and objectives, the fact that she is doing that across a broad number of organizations and not necessarily following the trend of many philanthropies at that size and scale that will look at a few core issues or a few core communities and go very deep. You know, she is showing that there are many different ways to be effective with philanthropy and that, again, you can do this now because we need philanthropists to do it now. I do think that there is room for additional transparency around how Mackenzie and her team are finding opportunities. I think that there is certainly a call for more transparency in the sector. And I think that there is an opportunity here to not only have Mackenzie and her team read out on the selection of their grantee partners and the justification, but to be able to talk through the process they're employing on the front end. And hopefully that will demystify some of how Mackenzie and her team are making decisions. And in full disclosure, we are a grateful recipient of a very generous $4 million gift from Mackenzie and Dan. And it has allowed us to scale our operations and advance our strategic plan in a meaningful way. And so I can, from a firsthand perspective, share how important it is to believe in organizations and to invest in them in a way that will allow them to, again, do their best work.
Well, that's terrific. Congratulations on receiving that funding. And I know you will be putting it to good use.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's so interesting that you mentioned transparency, and I certainly would not leave that to the Mackenzie Scott approach. There are many other philanthropic organizations out there that seem to make it a bit challenging to identify how to go about receiving funding. In fact, some of them don't accept unsolicited, many of them don't accept unsolicited proposals. And it's not always clear, you know, how an organization can go about receiving that funding. So good for you to call that out. I think we're all better, I think, when we know where our opportunities lie and have some access to the market for these kinds of resources.
Yeah, and the other thing, Art, I might add on this is that in addition to investing in a broad array of organizations, you know, McKinsey is also showing the sector that there's a different approach that philanthropists can take, right? An approach that is driven by trust, and that is so significant at this moment in time where we need to be trusting our grantee partners to be able to carry forward their mission in a way that doesn't inhibit their work.
Yeah. I'll have to add to what you just said, because our whole mission at the Wise Giving Alliance is to help charities express their trustworthiness to donating organizations and individuals for that matter. And it's so important for donors to know that they can trust organizations, because we've seen year in and year out that when people trust, they give more. And trust is different than actually achieving mission. But I think sometimes we get confused when we try to say that, well, this organization did not achieve its goals. Well, doesn't mean that they didn't work really hard at it. Doesn't mean that they didn't deserve the funding. It doesn't mean that they had bad ideas. They just weren't able to do it. It's a really hard problem that they're trying to solve. And that's different, though, than trust. Trust is being able to at least believe, and believe for a good reason, that people will mightily go after that objective with the resources and also adhere to the donor's intent with those funds. So I wanted to just point out the difference between one and the other, trust and sort of impact. I think organizations tend to be impactful. Sometimes it's hard to measure. Sometimes it is measurable, and maybe they didn't quite get the goal. But in the end, I think, you know, we want organizations to be aggressive in going after their objectives. We want them to set their goals high. And sometimes it might mean that they don't always achieve what they set out to do. But without that creativity and innovation and striving, we won't get there either. So just thought I would point that out. I guess you might agree with that.
I do. And I think it goes back to my earlier point about how we measure success and how we shift the definition of success, because opportunities that are not conventionally successful, to your point, opportunities that may have not met the outcomes that were defined, does not mean that those efforts were not successful. Because in fact, what they're doing is they're informing the way that we are going to, as a sector, approach those issues or look at different tools to be able to address what's needed. And so, again, each and every opportunity that is pursued is helping to inform the next. And we need to look less at the ultimate outcomes and look at the process itself and ask ourselves, are we learning? Are we growing? And make sure that we're not just tilting at windmills, but we're in fact advancing in our practice. And the only way that we can do that is by not meeting success in its conventional definition at times.
Yeah. When you think about families and how they go about making their gifts, what type of metrics do they tend to put on themselves? Can that be a barrier for some when they think about, well, how do we measure our success? You know, we're giving money to organizations. What does success look like for us? Do they measure it in terms of what the organizations do with the funding or just getting money out the door? What are some of their approaches to measuring their own success? And how important is that to families?
It's extremely important, and measurement is a complicated issue. And there's a lot that we can interrogate around measurement evaluation practices they need to shift, as do the mindsets of the donors and the individuals and families who are doing the work. There are a couple of approaches that individuals and families will often adopt in terms of a measurement strategy, rightfully or wrong on their part. The first is, and the most common, I will say, is measuring the impact of their work. So looking at what the organizations that they invest in are doing and how that ultimately is changing circumstances. So many individuals and families will want to look at how they can quantify by data the impact of their gift. And the issue here is that enduring meaningful change is often not easy to quantify in the near term. And quite honestly, even when you look at hard data around the impact of any one individual gift, it's not all that accurate because it is contribution versus attribution, right? The idea here that you and you alone are not the only reason that this work is being done and is being done successfully and the outcomes are met, right? You are a contributing factor to this, perhaps, but there is not complete attribution to you as the donor. And so, again, I think that it comes back to shifting how we think about measurement and looking at how we can better understand and listen to the needs of community and be able to trust that the implementing partners that are best positioned to do this work know that the rhythm that is needed and ultimately the path to success is a long one. And that is worth the investment. And yes, there are moments to check in on that work and make sure that your implementing partner is continuing to see progress and is heartened by the work that is happening or ask if any shifts are needed. But to, as a funder, rely on very clear data in the near term around your impact, I think is a false metric. And that's not to say that data doesn't have a place.
Yeah, sure.
But I think that it doesn't need to be absolute.
Yeah. I wanted to talk a bit about what you just raised, given the long-term nature of some of the challenges that organizations are trying to address, and compare that to a conversation that sort of goes on around, should philanthropies exist in perpetuity, or, you know, should we be spending them all down to deal with today's problems? Given that most of the problems are long-term, I would think that argues for, you know, longer-term solutions and maybe distributing funds over a long period of time. But then there's also this notion that today's problems should be handled by today's people and that in the future we'll deal with another group of donors to deal with those problems later on. Is there a middle ground? How do you think about it? How do you advise your families on that particular question?
The question of lifespan is so complicated, and I do believe that there is a middle ground. There are a few different opinions on this, right? More than a few, but I would say you can look at two different positions that are often juxtaposed to one another on lifespan. The first is that we as a philanthropy need to be a sustaining force in communities across generations, that grantee partners are going to rely on us, and that, to your point, problems are systemic and are going to be present for many generations, and therefore we as the philanthropy can contribute over generations to providing constant support. We can be a stable partner. And then on the opposite side of that is the perspective that there is a need for substantial investments in these issues and these communities now, and that any one individual philanthropy is not the sole sustaining force, but in fact there are and ought to be many other philanthropies that follow that individual, and therefore it's not up to any one individual philanthropy to be the constant in terms of the relationship with that issue or community. I do think that it's a very personal decision that comes back to philanthropic purpose. and really reflecting on why the institution is doing the work and what it hopes to see out of it. It's also a question of what's needed and what's needed from that institution and from the sector. It's also about opportunity. Is there a window of opportunity to be able to make a meaningful difference in an issue or a community at a given time with an investment of capital? And so what's clear to me, given a lot of questions that are less clear, is that the pace of giving must be accelerated. So whether that means that philanthropies that are planning to exist in perpetuity are flexing to make investments at moments in time when opportunity arises in a more meaningful and substantial way, or whether that means the question of lifespan is revisited and philanthropies shift to a more limited strategy, that is an individual decision. But what I will encourage all philanthropy to do is to look at the pace of giving and to reflect on how that might be accelerated, because it's absolutely clear that more capital is needed to address issues and to support communities. And so we need to ask ourselves how we're going to do that. And so there are a couple of ways. One is putting more capital to work now that is sitting on the sidelines, that is in endowments of institutions, and that is in donor-advised funds. The other is to hopefully get more players in the game, to get more people to recognize that philanthropy is non-optional, and that in fact, a part of being a wealth holder is actually putting that capital back into community and doing that with intentionality.
So Nick, what are some of the trends you're seeing in family philanthropy right now, and how are they unfolding from what you're seeing?
I'm so glad you asked the question, Art. We are in a moment of shift in family philanthropy. We talk about three major shifts: the shifts in pace, the shifts in practice, and the shifts in purpose. And I'll touch on them briefly, but first, the pace of giving is accelerating. We're seeing that families are shifting into action. They're giving big. They're giving now. And the current moment is very much a reminder of the long-held belief that philanthropic dollars serve as risk capital for innovation and social impact. And it's also clear that safe approaches are not sufficient. And so in many ways, philanthropic families are being asked to revisit their approach and to be bold. And the second shift that we're seeing is how the practice of giving is shifting. Philanthropy is normalizing a trust-based approach that is accelerating learning and partnership, and working to minimize power dynamics and the burden on grantees. So we're seeing that families are leveraging multi-year grants and fewer reporting requirements. They're shifting to general operating support. And we're seeing that they're starting to, in many ways, listen to the communities that they seek to serve and understand the need to be more closely connected to those most proximate to the work. The last shift that we're seeing is a shift in purpose. Philanthropic families are truly revisiting why they're choosing to do this work. Philanthropy is a conscious decision, one that you have to make time and time again. And in this moment, the concept of stewardship is being challenged as society continues to reckon with very long-standing oppression and systemic injustice. And so donors are being asked to reflect on how they're managing funds that are earmarked for the public good. And so this is a moment where many philanthropic families are pausing to ask, why are we doing this work? And what do we expect out of this? And what is needed from us? And so the purpose is being revisited.
Fantastic. I wanted to shift just a little bit and talk about a big challenge that we've seen. There was a study that came out recently by the Lilly Family School of Philanthropy that found that from 2000 to 2018, the percentage of families donating to charity dropped from 66% to 49.5%. And who knows what's causing that, but obviously that is a big concern. And it seems that we haven't lost out in terms of the amount of money going to charity, because the Giving USA statistics point out that we raised the second highest sum of money ever, I think, last year. And yet we see a decline in the number of families actually giving. What's your sense of what's happening? And what do we need to do in your opinion, to change that?
I think that there are many people in our society that are overwhelmed with the complexities of social issues. And I think there is an increased understanding that these are systemic issues. They're based on racist systems that have been longstanding in our society. And I think that there are many individuals and families that, for better or for worse, throw up their hands and ask what their dollars are going to do to change broken and biased systems. And I think a lot of individuals in their day-to-day lives are observing the persistent challenges throughout their communities and asking again, how might their capital actually make a difference? And so what you're seeing, I think, is a bit of fatigue on the part of many donors. What I hope that we can do is we can start to have a conversation around the pathways to success and really start to name the opportunities to change the systems. And the way that we're going to do that is in partnership with one another, the notion of stronger together. So can we start to create more opportunity for a collective conversation on what we as a society might do to contribute to more meaningful and enduring outcomes to address the issues that are pervasive in community? And can we start to bridge a narrative of optimism and hope? Can we also start to ask what's needed from individuals and families at all wealth levels?
Obviously, this is a big concern because our democracy is sort of built on this idea of individual action and the freedom that we have to associate with groups and individuals to solve our own problems. Our country wasn't built as one that depends totally on government to do things. And if people don't support these organizations, then I suspect they're not really voting for that approach anymore. Now, I do want to ask you, we also have noticed that there are new ways that people are deploying to contribute to society. It isn't always through nonprofit organizations. Have you seen any examples of families that are saying, well, we can do some good through the traditional philanthropic tools, but there's some other ways that we think we can contribute to society that may not involve tax-exempt organizations or those structures? What are you seeing there?
Absolutely. We are seeing the practice of philanthropy shifting quite substantially into what you're defining as, you know, a total portfolio activation mentality on this. And when you think about the portfolio, it goes beyond financial. The idea here that traditional grants are not enough, and there is an awareness that traditional grants are not enough. So families are asking themselves, what more can we do? And that often comes in the form of investments in entrepreneurs that are looking at innovative solutions, looking at leveraging debt to be able to help nonprofit organizations or for-profit entities get to a place of sustainability. It's also looking at your voice, your influence as an individual or a family, and the efforts around advocacy that might change the systems themselves and contribute to a coalition of supporters that ultimately can shift a narrative. So we're seeing individuals and families move beyond the traditional tools of grant making and look at, again, the total portfolio and how they can contribute to meaningful outcomes with more than tax-exempt dollars.
Another question I have is really around access to these kinds of philanthropic and, in some cases, business investments. I know that many people who are needing these resources to accomplish things don't necessarily have access. They don't quite know how to identify where these sources are and who to talk to and so forth. What do we tell families to particularly reach organizations that are led by people of color are serving disadvantaged communities. How do we get the word out to them? How do families become more visible and accessible around these kinds of opportunities? You know, I used to laugh because there's an organization that I'm a member of and I love. It used to be the old Independent Sector Conference. Dan has sort of changed it since he's come on board. But I used to always laugh because I'm a grantee, always a grant seeker, you know. And one of the big no-nos at an Independent Sector Conference back then was that you couldn't ask a funder for funds if you went to an Independent Sector Conference. And I always thought that was kind of, I don't know. No, if we couldn't access you then, when will we get a chance to access you now? And I always felt if I ever got to be a grant maker, I would always say to a person who asked, well, let's talk about it, or maybe the answer is no, but I wouldn't hope that people wouldn't come up to me and ask me for funds. I mean, that's why I'm there. Ask me for funds, you know? So I don't know. I was just curious, how do we create a more open marketplace for grantees and grant makers?
This is the billion-dollar question. The question of how do we create, is it possible to create a marketplace for ideas and opportunities? Yeah. I am hopeful. The way that we advise philanthropic families to pursue learning about ideas and opportunities is to connect with other families, is to network, to meet peers and to ask questions around what they're funding and why they believe in what they're funding and what they might do differently. And so what we try to do is facilitate as many introductions here at the National Center for Family Philanthropy as possible so peers can connect with peers and be in honest dialogue around how they are finding opportunities, what those opportunities are, and whether or not there is room for partnership on those opportunities. And so I do believe that that is one of the most fundamental things that philanthropy needs to continue to do, which is to create space for the individuals and families to connect with one another and to learn from one another and to grow together. And that is the closest thing to a marketplace that we have. There's questions around the role of technology, and is that a way to access ideas and opportunities? You then get into the crisis of choice issue again, right? How do you start to narrow down the opportunities, and how do you effectively rank opportunities when there's so many qualitative measures that are meaningful to individuals and families based on their own positioning that may not be as meaningful to others? And so we come back to the idea of a network, and that's truly what we are born out of and continue to advance.
Well, let me ask you about the National Center itself. And since you've come on, as we mentioned, you're stepping into some mighty big shoes. What are some of your plans and the plans of the organization over the next 5 to 10 years or so to continue to prosper with your mission?
Thank you for the question. For those of you who have not yet had a chance to explore the National Center for Family Philanthropy, we are a 25-year-old organization that is a network of families who are committed to learning and growing together. And in the coming years, we're going to be making some shifts in our model. And I'll touch on a couple of these shifts. First, we are really looking at how we can elevate a conversation on effective family philanthropy. So really looking at how we, alongside a coalition of partners, can continue to keep philanthropic practices that are effective, like equity at the center, like collaboration, employing trust-based practices. How can we keep those as a fundamental part of the dialogue on what it means to be a family who gives? We're then looking at how we can equip philanthropic families and their partners with the tools and the resources and the community to be able to orient towards effective outcomes. And what we're going to be doing is we're going to be creating a number of program tools that will allow for deeper extended learning, peer-based learning, cohort learning that is led by experts, experts external to our organization. We have launched a few pilots. One of them is a racial justice learning and action network that is taking a number of families through a multi-month curriculum to explore how they might realize a commitment to racial justice in their governance and their grant-making practices. We are launching a similar network on impact investing and one on trust-based philanthropy practices. And so the idea is that we are going to provide the space for peers to come together and to learn alongside each other and to change practices and to have a safe space to be able to do that, that again is expert led. And lastly, we are employing a strategy of helping to activate families and their partners through a continuity of learning and through an opportunity to be in deeper dialogue with those families, to be able to suggest more learning opportunities and peer connections that will allow them to carry forward what they are hearing and what they aspire to do.
Fantastic. I'm so glad to hear you mention among the list of opportunities to help them focus on diversifying their governance. I think one way we can begin to get organizations out there and to find unique and novel approaches and reach communities that don't have this access is to diversify those boards in some way. And I know that's not always easy for families, but I think it can be highly helpful in terms of identifying great opportunities to change our societies in good ways and to really amplify and uplift the great work that's going on that is sometimes unnoticed in organizations that don't have that access. I'll never forget, too, I had a conversation recently with Sam Cobbs, who is the CEO at the Tipping Point Community. And Sam said, you know, one of the things that I learned as a grantee is that it's not always the organization with the best proposal and the slickest presentation that you want to fund. Sometimes it's the Aunt Betty who's in the community, who everybody knows, who everything's kind of funneled through her, but not everyone knows about her in the philanthropic space. And sometimes we have to look past what we get in terms of documentation, as hard as that is, and really get into these communities and understand who those really stars are in these communities that you really want to support. So I hope that's part of your thinking too, Nick. And I think that's one way. There are many ways we need to do with this, but that's one way.
Yeah, Sam is a wise man, and I couldn't agree more. This is a moment in time where families need to reflect on the concept of stewardship, and they need to ask themselves, how are they making decisions, and who are making the decisions with them, in partnership with them? And to your point, this is where families must look beyond the construct of family as a decision-making body, the governance framework for their philanthropy, and invite in independent and community voices, those that are proximate to the issues, and have them be partners in the decision-making. Because that's the only way that we are going to be more informed as philanthropists and as a sector. And that's the only way that we're going to ultimately see a shift in how the work is done and in the results that come from that work itself.
Nick, as we get toward the end of our conversation, what do you see as the potential for family philanthropy? Especially now, you've mentioned that we're going through some shifts. But what is the ultimate potential for family philanthropy?
Family philanthropy is so uniquely positioned to advance meaningful, enduring change. It's a critical lever for social progress. You know, we're all familiar with the adage that philanthropic capital is risk capital, as I mentioned earlier. We're also all familiar with the bureaucracy that often embroils philanthropic institutions. And family philanthropy has the opportunity to be nimble because it's donor-directed. And I say the opportunity because in many instances, it's not fully realized. So we encourage donors to reflect on their purpose, as I mentioned earlier, and the opportunity at hand, and reflect on the truth that this is a historic moment in time for family philanthropy, because it's a moment of decisions. It's a moment where families will either choose to break free from the practices that perhaps they have relied on for years or generations that may not be serving community to its full extent, and start to orient and adopt new practices, bring in new decision makers, and pursue their philanthropy in a more equitable and more inclusive manner with an eye towards community. Or we can continue to move forward in the same way that we have for years and generations. And so again, this is a truly historic moment for family philanthropy because we can decide as a sector to be a bolder version of ourselves. And I think that that's where we need to start to orient ourselves as we look ahead.
Well, it's my hope that we will change. Change seems to be the hopeful direction right now. Well, Nick, I want to just thank you for taking this time to speak with me about your work and your life and what families are trying to do to help our society move forward. And I am just really excited that you're in this role, and I look forward to the great work that you're going to do in the years ahead.
Thank you so much, Art. It's an absolute pleasure to be in conversation with you, and I appreciate the invitation.
This is the Heart of Giving podcast. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll listen to other episodes by just going to any of the major podcast platforms. You can also follow us and subscribe on Patreon if you want to make a donation, patreon.com. And also make a comment on, especially on Apple Podcasts. We would love to get a favorable review on Apple Podcasts because that helps us to build audience. Thank you very much.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's terms of service.